Hey everyone, welcome again to the ManaCast, conversations about a vision of life that is truly good news for us, for our neighbours, and for the world. My name's Jacob Garrett, with me is Jonathan Cornford.
G'day folks.
ManaCast is the podcast of Managum. Managum's all about the intersection of faith with economy and ecology, and this episode is a part three. So if you haven't listened to the first two, you might want to go back and do that, because we're doing a little series on the Constantinian shift.
Is this our first three-part series, Jacob?
I think so. I think we did a two-parter on vocation, but I don't think we've done a three-part before. So we're getting big for our boots here. Today, we're discussing what the stuff we've talked about in the last two episodes might mean for us today in 21st century Australia. Before we get into that, though, we want to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands we live and work on. I'm talking to you today from a very cool, sort of threatening rain day on Wurundjeri land in south central Victoria in Melbourne.
And I'm just over the range in central Victoria in Jarjabarang land from the same language group, but where the day is going to be a fair bit warmer and brighter, I reckon, than in Melbourne, which is why I live up here and not down
as
there.
As is typical. We'd like to acknowledge these peoples as the traditional custodians of these lands, and we pay our respects to their elders past and present. So it's important to say at the outset of this episode that the things we're discussing are very complex issues. There may not be a single obvious way forward. Instead, we want to sort of toss these ideas around and see what we come to, see what sort of problems it brings up, and lay out some of these things for us, contextualizing them for our situation in Australia in 2024. So, John, I guess the first thing to say is, what is that situation? How do we understand ourselves in the light of Constantine and the legacy of this stuff now?
Yeah, right. Okay. Yes, I have to say I'm a little bit nervous about this episode too, because we could go so many different directions, but
totally.
We'll just see how we go. Look, so we've sort of fast-forwarded 1,700 years, you know, more than a millennium and a half, and through to literally the other side of the planet. Which is sort of bizarre when you think about all the things that have gone on in between then and here. That's a lot of water under the bridge.
Yes.
So we're not going to try and describe that water under the bridge. But to say where we are here at the moment in 21st century Australia, I think we can say a few things pretty clearly. The first thing is to say that Christianity is no longer the favoured religion of the state. So that is well and truly ended now. So we are in a post-Christendom era. So Christendom has finished this sort of special relationship between Christianity, whether we talk about Christianity abstractly, as in the more American sense, or the church, where in England, Britain, where they have an established church. The relationship between Christianity and straight in a country like Australia is very clearly gone. And even in England, where they have an established church, it's actually, you know, it's not really there in the same way. So we live in a post-Christendom world. The church can no longer count upon the state to either to defend it. If it did, it can't seek to have its views implemented through the state. It can't even expect the state necessarily to listen to it in the way it once could. So we live in a post-Christendom state, and that means also it means it says something about not just the relationship between church and state, but also the nature of society. So in a post-Christendom world, we no longer think, we can't talk about Australia as a Christian society anymore. Once upon a time, so in the, say, like the 1950s, in fact, for most of Australia's history, people would have, irrespective of your particular views, would have just as a reflex described Australia as a Christian society or a Christian civilization. Even if you were a bit of a, even if you didn't particularly have a faith yourself, you just would have said that as the fairly matter-of-fact thing. These days, we are a post-Christian society, which is, I think, really significant to say post-Christian, because it's very different to say non-Christian society. because the relationship between Christianity and society is quite different. We're in a case where society for a very long period has had this identification with Christianity, which it has now rejected. And that's significant. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. Many of them very understandable reasons. And they go back to what we've been talking about. We live in the legacy. We live in the shadow of Christendom and with the legacy of Christendom now, where a lot have the rejection of Christianity has, not entirely, but has very much to do with the failures of the church or the failures of Christian government, quote unquote, or the failures of Christian society, quote unquote, over the last millennia and a half that we've seen in all sorts of different ways, from the wars between Christian nations against each other through to colonialism and imperialism and the racism that's gone with that, slavery, all the sorts of depredations, treatment of women, treatment of minorities, all sorts of things. And we're now in the world of the blowback against that, and that's pretty understandable. There's other stuff going on there, but it just says something that it's not just a non-Christian society, but particularly so in Australia, I think it's fair to say that we live in the midst of, at least amongst a certain sector of society, it's not just people have said no to Christian faith. There's actually some sort of hostility to it and animus.
Or at least suspicion and caution and reluctance to go there.
I think animus captures it right. As a bad feeling, I don't think anti-Christian is too strong. Although I think there is a little bit of that. But actually, just the idea that for a lot of people, it raises negative feelings in a way that religion generally, and we, you know, particularly, you know, people seem to feel quite warm and fuzzily about Buddhism, for example, you know, generally without understanding much about it. They have feelings about Christianity specifically in ways that they don't necessarily have about religion generally, although that's obviously also a pretty diverse set of views out there.
Yeah, so we're kind of living on the other side of something, not just the lack of Christianity. It's where we've been through it. That's that water under the bridge with everything that that comes for with people. It's freighted. It's got associations.
Exactly. So one way to perhaps sum it up, and I mentioned this just to you before while we were talking, just yesterday, so there's been a few days since we recorded the last episode. Yesterday was Sunday, and I ended up giving the message at our local church here in Longgully, and it was on the temptation narrative, the temptation of Christ, Matthew chapter 4, which is a classic Lent reading. We're in the season of Lent at the moment. Lent is a model after Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. And one way of understanding that text is Jesus, in clarifying what sort of Messiah he's going to be. And the challenge from Satan to Christ is, if you are the Son of God, that is, if you are the Messiah, do this. And Jesus is clarifying, no, I'm not that sort of Messiah. I'm going to be this sort of Messiah. And what he's saying no to three times is three different forms of power. And so I'm not the only one who says this. This has been noticed by many commentators on the Bible. Effectively, you could summarize it as Jesus rejecting economic power, intellectual or philosophical power, the different ways you could frame that, and coercive power. So he rejects these things and instead goes about a way of calling people, calling free wills to the kingdom of God and to the way of love. So Jesus said no to those things. One way of understanding what happened in the Constantinian shift, and we want to state again, as we were saying, trying to wrestle with, there's so much going on and it's not just all good and not all bad. But one thing that is at the heart of that was, in some ways, in a quite deep way, the church ultimately said yes to those three things. And we are now living with the consequences of that yes, and we're having to, and I think it's part of our work to unravel the meaning of it, you know, now is to what may have seemed responsible choices in terms of choosing for power in all different contexts to Christians at the time have in the long historical arc had all sorts of other consequences. And now we're having to try and unravel the meaning of all those things and sort one thing out from another.
And it sort of brings me to one of my first thoughts around this stuff for today is like, there's a feeling within some subsections of Christianity that there's a very strong awareness of that misuse of power and the abuses of the past and even ongoing, that there's a kind of desire to right the wrongs, step back and really like come at these things fresh, but also to attempt to make amends for those sorts of things by the way we now proceed to be Christians in the world. There's kind of a, in the light of all that's been, we almost need to make up for it kind of approach. And then there's like another section of society that's, or Christians that are sort of going, well, we need to keep pushing for what we see as right in the world, even though we might get it wrong, that's the only way forward. And there's kind of a pretty strong tension between those two ways of understanding our situation.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I think I have a sense of what you're saying.
There's like people that go, well, we now abused power. We don't even deserve to have it anymore. Let's actively eschew it, give it up, and pursue a lack of power and work from there. And then there's people who go, okay, yes, things did not go well, but that doesn't mean we should give it up. We need to just like rethink about how we use it from here.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's been one sense in which you're saying that Christian, there's a need to reject politics because that's, you know, that's everything went wrong when we went there. And others are saying we just need to be clearer about what we stand for or something like that.
Yeah, we just need a different way of approaching the question because clearly we didn't get it all right.
Yeah. Look, I think one way into some of those questions, maybe we should is to have to return to a couple of our thinkers from last episode, John Howard Yoder and Oliver O'Donovan, and ask what they might offer us in helping think through our moment and where we are, and you know how we think about the times, and then how we try and act in our own times. So I'll start with Oliver O'Donovan. His famous book was The Desire of Nations, and he had a follow-up book called The Ways of Judgment. And these are basically works of political theology, where he's talking, really reclaiming a theology of political authority. And in The Ways of Judgment, actually really provides us really amazing examination of the foundations of Western the idea of a Western liberal constitutional government and representative government. And he breaks down the concept of separation of powers of the executive, legislature, and judiciary, and all these sorts of things. Really, in terms of political theory and not just political theology, really profound stuff. What O'Donovan gives us, and I think he does really well. I don't go with him on everything. Sometimes I'm not convinced. But what I think he does establish fairly well is he gives Christians reasons to support and value the institutions that have grown out of Christendom in the Christian, quote unquote, Christian West. And he's not, even though I don't fully agree with everything he says, he's not blind to the hypocrisies of Christendom and the failures as well, even if I don't think he quite talks about them enough. He's not blind to them, but he does, I think, provide good reason to value what is good that has come out of these things, and to support the institutions of representative parliamentary democracy and the political virtues that these are based on, the ideas of freedom of speech and freedom of conscience and freedom of association. And this whole system, its health is dependent then on people being it's dependent on active political citizenship, right? So that we've birthed this system that is made more healthy by the more active its citizens are within the polis. So I think that's one thing to take account of, reasons to think, if not positively about what's going on in politics, it's pretty hard to be, but to at least see the importance of this thing that we have, and to not just go, nah, let's just turn away from that whole world.
Yeah, not baby out with bathwater.
Yeah, exactly. On the other hand, John Howard Yoder, he is, I don't think, so good for helping us think about, he doesn't really think much about, he doesn't have a good theology of government. In fact, he doesn't have he really sees government as simply the monopoly of violence. He sees it as necessary. We need government to maintain order, but that's about it. So he doesn't help, but what he does help us with, I think, is for our particular situation, and especially here in Australia, is what he's really strong on is understanding Christianity as a minority ethic. And that's what we really need to relearn and reclaim the skills of, because we've been so long living in the world of Christianity as the favored religion and Christianity as this supposed religion of society that we've just developed. The way our theology is constructed, the way our language is constructed, the way we tell the stories of the faith in so many ways have been constructed with that presumption. And we need to now learn to re-understand our faith and the way we understand it and communicate it from the perspective of that being a minority and in a hostile culture. And so Howard is good. John Howard Yoder, not John Howard. We might get to him later. This gets a bit confusing. Yoder is good for really rethinking discipleship and the lived ethics of Christianity. The idea that Christianity can't... not imagining that we represent the moral voice of the community, and even to accept when we need to that we perhaps our own voice may be denied, which in some cases feels like it, you know, there's maybe a little bit of that going on.
And is that a can't or a shouldn't, do you think? Like someone like we talked about last time, Peter Leithart, he might say in certain contexts where Christians were the majority voice, they're now the minority voice or a minority voice. But my understanding from what you were saying is he wouldn't see that situation perpetuated. He would seek to become the majority voice again. So that's like we can't right now, but actually we should seek to be in that position. Whereas it seems like Yoder maybe is more okay with we can't, and also we probably shouldn't seek that kind of role.
I think you're mixing up the voice and the seeking to be the dominant role. So what he was saying is... paying attention to our historical circumstances and what we can and cannot communicate. So communication, the possibilities of communication are dependent upon how and what people can hear. So we shouldn't imagine. So in the past, the church has assumed and been able to assume that it represents a morally credible and morally authoritative voice in quote-unquote Christian societies and can speak forth. And people will listen and go, oh, the church said that. We cannot assume that now. And in fact, even to use religious words will often just cause people to turn their ears off. And, you know, and even if you said good things, they won't hear it because you used religious words to say that.
Totally.
So we need to find ways of what can we communicate and how do we communicate it? So he's not saying don't try and communicate. But to accept the conditions with which you're being faced with. And if you're in a minority position, you need to learn to accept those conditions and operate within them. So what he's saying is just because a culture may be hostile to you doesn't mean you can't communicate within it, but you need to. So he thinks that that's what the early church managed to do. And I think we've been saying the same. So I think he's good for that. He's a bit too, that's... he doesn't really think of then, or no, that's not entirely true. He has a little bit to say about getting more involved in the public and the political, but he's actually some of it's okay. but that's where he's most useful to us, I think. That's two ways of thinking about. So O'Donovan saying giving us cause to think about being involved politically actively, and then Yoda saying the need to relearn a new way of being a minority voice and what it means to inhabit that space and to be, and then to combine the two, I think that what it means to be active political citizens coming from a minority ethic. So not to assume that everyone accepts us as the moral authority in society, to realize that we have to actually communicate and convince to demonstrate rather than just preach.
Yeah. Demand or hold court about it.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. And it's particularly fascinating because we've had a number of prime ministers recently in the last decade or so, decade and a half, who have professed Christian faith as part of their public identity. Something that we know about them and something they hold to. But I know that your view is that most of them have participated really in that kind of Constantinian holding forth rather than earning it or showing by their life that these things are of value. Is that right?
I'm very, very glad you brought up the case of our recent Christian prime ministers. It's, it's almost as if we may have talked about this beforehand. three instances in recent history, Kevin Rudd, Tony Abbott and Scott Morrison in particular were known as quite declared Christians. I think there was always, who was the guy before Scott Morrison? I'm having a complete mental blank right at the moment. Malcolm Turnbull, sorry.
Yeah, only briefly.
No one really, he was sort of a low-key Anglican. I don't think anyone took his Christian faith particularly seriously. But Kevin Rudd, Tony Abbott, and Scott Morrison were out there as Christians and Christians in politics and as Christian prime ministers. Each of them made a point of that. So Kevin Rudd, during his Kevin 07 campaign, before getting elected, wrote a essay. What was it in? Anyway, a prominent journal, I can't remember which Australian journal, about basically a Christian view of politics. And he quoted Dietrich Bonhoeffer and he referenced Christian socialism and things like that. Seemed pretty radical. It got a lot of Christians excited. Tony Abbott, clearly and for a lot of people notoriously, was a conservative Catholic. And he really staked his allegiance to Archbishop George Pell, then the Archbishop, the arch-conservative Archbishop in Sydney, he really staked his claim to a particular form of Catholicism. And Scott Morrison, a Pentecostal Christian. I think Kevin Rudd is an Anglican, if I'm right.
I don't know.
I think so.
You don't want to know how old I was in 07.
Oh, no. Right. So you're not remembering these out from your own memory
Kevin Rudd was around for a while, but I wasn't exactly actively politically minded when I was in my teen years.
Okay, right. Still feels like recent history to me. Look, so these have been three prominently Christian prime ministers, and I think they've been disastrous prime ministers. Simply just as prime ministers, I think, let alone as Christians. So they've been bad prime ministers from a straight political, not managing politics well, really not getting much good done and actually often having quite negative impacts. But as Christians, I think they've been, this is going to sound a bit strong.
These are fighting words, John.
They have certainly contributed, I think, to the animus against Christians. They've just reinforced that narrative. So just to give you a little bit of history, so Kevin Rudd elected to went in 2007 to government. That was when he tipped out John Howard, also a guy who sort of was known as a Christian prime minister, although never someone with a particularly strident faith, more your sort of old style conservative, I think Anglican, I think he was maybe. But he, you know, he was sort of a, you know, Christian in the cultural Christian sort of sense. Kevin Rudd tipped him out and it was a declared for Christian and, you know, had written an article about Christians in politics, which all seemed very exciting. And then in gets into government and it's almost like he imagined he was Constantine, the emperor, because he just became this this maniacal tyrant in government. And so there's people talking in 2007, 2008 about this, basically the jam up of Canberra. And to be fair with them, the global financial crisis has happened at the same time. But he just wanted to control everything. So he wanted to have his hands in every department, on all his cabinet ministers. And I was back at the time, I was working in the development industry and doing some trips to Canberra. And just from lower bureaucrats, they confirmed just from the ground level that Canberra, the system had jammed up. And so being from, he had this huge popular victory, one of the largest margins in history. So incredibly popular prime minister when he was voted in. A year later, he was turfed out by his own party because he was so disastrous and the government had stopped functioning effectively. It was dire. And so hard. I mean, I don't think they should have turfed him out because, you know, he was an elected prime minister and he'd only been in the job for 1 year. But I can sort of also see there why they did it, because things had gotten so dire and just actually the operations of government. So he was disastrous because he thought he wanted to control everything. He was a basically control freak, off the scale control freak. And also people found him impossible to work with just at a human level. Tony Abbott, summarize him. Depends. He got very different treatment from whether it was in the Murdoch press, who loved him, and to say the Fairfax press, Age, and the Sydney Morning Herald, or then the Guardian as well, the sort of more progressive press. In the progressive press, he was talked about as the mad monk. Because he had actually trained in seminary, so there was a fair bit of prejudice in on their side. But and then the Murdoch press loved him because, you know, he was really anti doing it. He tore a wrecking ball through any previous advances around climate change initiatives that had been made. He pushed a whole bunch of things, but he came to power by really amping up pretty misogynist attacks on Gillard, and this sort of new, very aggressive anti-politics where he explicitly stated when he was in opposition, he said at one point, our job is just to be against the government. It wasn't to try and be a voice of deliberation. He just saw himself, his role in as being against
a leader of an opposition.
And he really amped that up to a whole new level. And that's sort of set the climate of politics since. That's been a really negative effect on things. And then Scott Morrison sort of grew up in that culture within the coalition parties and learned at the, you know, he was around when Tony Abbott was prime minister and he became prime minister. And look, I think you can argue his government was pretty disastrous in a bunch of ways too, actually, and frankly incompetent, frighteningly incompetent, a bunch of things. They did some things okay. They really ham-fisted foreign international relations terribly. They just did not understand the world. Their administration was terrible, so they had some. I think they tried to do some walk a careful line around COVID, but they bungled the public administration side of things so badly. Anyway, And then it came out, you know, Scott Morrison had promoted himself to be a cabinet minister 6 or 7 times round or something, you know, and lied and blah, blah, blah.
And in terms of the public face and public reaction, or even just in how we should think about them, in what way do you think their Christianity and their public profession of Christianity, like, ties into these bungles or these personalities?
So I think I probably talked it to extended length, but I think the one way we can summarize them each is that Christians have been excited by, and, you know, having Christians in parliament, and surely that's self-evidently a good thing. You know, if parliament's there and it's representative democracy, so it's a good thing that we have Christians, as if the word Christians somehow captures something that is good. And I think in this case shows it doesn't. What each of these cases represent shows is all of these guys really had a massive deficiencies of moral character. They all lied. They all were controlling. They all backstabbed. They all betrayed. They all stood on people mercilessly, none of them were particularly liked, were disliked by many people. So that they were, you know, not attractive human beings. So in terms of what sort of Christian were they, going back to I can't remember if it was episode or 1 or 2, they were like the new sort of Christian that became possible after the accession of Constantine. Very unlike the early sort of Christian who, to become a Christian in the first place, had to go through this intensive process of re-socialization and learning a new moral character, being prepared to suffer rather than do wrong to another person, to reject forms of advancing yourself against another person, all these sorts of incredible disciplines that the early Christians learnt and had to learn intensively. They don't show any of that.
Rather than a dog-eat-dog, but yeah. I'll wear the label, but I'll still play by the same rules.
Yeah, somehow it seems to be enough to owe your allegiance to Christ, at least by lip service, and then behave as any politician would. And I think we're seeing just how disastrous that is, and we should be learning from that.
What do you think we should take from it?
I think what we should take from it is that... So what these guys have grown up as Christians in a church that really did nothing in terms of moral formation and Christian formation in discipleship. They don't seem to be shining lights of Christian formation. It shows to me that one of the great tasks for us in the post-Christendom, post-Christian era is to relearn and remake Christian formation.
And in terms of the public life, I feel as though some Christians I know from different parts of Australia versus other parts, some have a view of, disappointment in sort of shallow moral character of professed Christian leaders, but still get out there and still be in the public eye, but just do it better. And versus some Christians have a sort of like, well, let's just keep our heads down and do our thing for a bit.
Is that a question?
Well, not necessarily who's right, but like you can have an emphasis on discipleship and approach public life in more than one way.
Absolutely. Look, in principle, I think that's and here's where it gets complex, right? Because we're in messy times, and we're in a transition period from one thing to another thing, and we're still having to figure out what that looks like for us. I think we're very much still in, we've still got a fair bit to unlearn before we can relearn. We're in this disentanglement phase. So I think, you know, that in principle, we need being involved. You know, I think Christians can and should be able to still think about being involved in politics. And yet another sense, we need to find new ways of doing that. So we can't just do that in the old ways we've done that. So let me just give one example, which is the marriage equality plebiscite that took place in 2017. Now, that's I raise that very cautiously because that's so polarized and divisive, the views around that sort of thing. I don't want to get into the into that. I don't know if we'll ever do that, but I just want to at least pay attention to the presumptions around Christians in politics. So so here I'm going to pay attention to the No campaign, and because what you see in the No campaign is the idea that a Christian sexual ethic is different from the norm, and that's actually a pretty controversial position. That's been the presumption. That was certainly the presumptions of the early Christians. So they had a very different sexual ethic from and marriage ethic from the Roman world around them, but they never presumed that they could somehow tell the rest of society, it just didn't cross their minds, how to live in terms of what they did do, presume to do, was call people into their community, right? But they didn't imagine they could just impose their marriage ethic and sexual ethic on others. In our plebiscite, we have that we still shows the idea that so that when Christians have a different sexual ethic from mainstream society, and that in itself should not be, I don't think, is remarkable. But the idea that we should be seeking the coercive powers of state to limit and protect our view of marriage shows precisely the maintenance of a Christendom mindset, that we haven't let go of the idea that actually we are now in the minority, and that the marriage plebiscite showed that very clearly, not to mention the divisions within the Christian household around that issue. But just in the way we think about politics, and I think you can argue as similar cases for the left on other issues as well, on the progressive left, where they still presume if this is our view, it should be legislated. Now, we're entering tricky territory there, and I don't want to get to... But, you know, I think we've got a bit to unlearn, and we're in the position of needing to find a new way of being active political citizens and Christians, but in ways that take account of our minority position, seeking to bear witness to Christ without making Christ's name even harder to hear than it already is at the moment.
But that kind of gets to what I mean by like keep your head down, as it seems like some Christians have the response of, oh, it's just there's so much bad blood and there's so much bad association, we'll just like keep quiet for a bit, maybe even be non-active in the political conversations for a bit in order to kind of let the waters settle. And other Christians saying like, well, we just need to keep doing it better, remain just as active as before. But then that seems to maybe risk a kind of muddying the waters even further.
Sure. So I think here we need to make a distinction between being involved in the public world and the political world as quote unquote Christians, or rather, and Christians being involved in the public and political world. And I think this is a helpful distinction to make. The way we keep thinking is we've got to be out there speaking as Christians to Australians, saying, you know, whatever the issue is, whether it's sexual ethics or climate change, this is our view of the moral world. This is what we understand to be right. We think this is a good thing. When actually, as soon as you say in Australian politics, you know, speaking from a Christian moral ethic, then you've pretty much cut off most of your audience. However, what we do get from the gospel, I want to argue this case very strongly, is a very clear sense of right and wrong, what's good, what is good for life, what are the conditions for life. And we've been arguing that case on this podcast and in Manor Matters for a long time. We can understand what that requires, say, for example, the climate change, or even in terms of sexual ethics, and talk about that from the basis we can be involved in a public conversation around the good without necessarily having to require people to say, yes, okay, we agree with your Christian perspective on that. So I think there is a case to make that in an institutional sense, at least on some issues, at least, Christians in an organized sense, so I'm talking here about organized Christianity or the church or Christian institutions, should shut up for a period. That we sort of need to fall silent because our voice has become, creates pain.
Yeah, there they go again kind of thing.
Yeah, because of the, and that's largely because of an own goal. You know, we're reaping the judgments of history. You know, you reap what you sow. And the church is, the blowback of the failures of the historical church.
And you've written about that in Man of Matters 2020, I think, Moral Ecology of Judgment.
Yes. Yep. So we wrote a series on this idea of judgment taking place and within history. And I think the position of the contemporary Christian church is one reasonably clear example of that. So we need to accept that. And perhaps there are some cases for the Christian institutions saying, okay, we shouldn't stop being actively supporting our members, teaching, instructing, even having views on things, but we might need to dial back on the whole public voice thing because we realize that is not necessary. That may be counterproductive in some cases.
Or at least doing it under that explicit Christian label, like as Christians this, as Christians that.
But there's no reason why the members, we can't be people out in the world getting involved in the things where we see the good that needs to be done and going and doing that. And that includes the political world. What we really need, whatever we get, whether it's the good in our work, our vocation, and we talked about this in the vocation episode, or it's the good that needs to be done in the world of politics, what we need more than anything to be able to do that is one, to have a clearer view of what the good is and to be formed in the moral character of that and the disciplines that takes. And that, so I'm talking about moral character, but actually what we're really talking about is being formed in Christ. Having a much clearer sense of Christian discipleship, that whatever language we speak and whether we use secularized language or whether we can start to use some, bring in some religious language is sort of, you know, by the by. What we really need more than anything is to know how to behave as followers of Christians in this context and to have a clear sight at any point in time of what the good is. And how, when we have a clear understanding of what the good is, we can speak about it in different languages. We can be bilingual. We can find the way to pursue it, the best way to pursue that in the here and now, given the potentialities or the limitations of our context. That's what we need, I think. So back to that whole question of moral formation and Christian formation.
And all of that's, it sounds like, accepting of that minority status rather than trying to reclaim or rejig a majority voice.
Absolutely. I think that is the baseline. We just have to accept that because I think that's still got a way to go. I don't think we've hit the bottom of that yet, actually.
Yeah. And when we were talking about what we might get into in this episode, and we've talked about this on the previous ones in this series as well, it seems like two of the major points where Christianity and power contact and the rubber hits the road in our context is violence and wealth. We don't really want to get into the Christians and wealth in our context too much on this episode because we've written about that quite a bit in Man of Matters and even other episodes of this podcast, but we haven't really talked about Christianity and violence or coercive force that much, either in Man of Matters or on this podcast. So what do you reckon, John? Like, Yoda's got his view that pretty much government's a necessary evil of coercive force. How should Christians approach the violence inherent in any state power just running itself as a state power?
Come and see the violence inherent in the state. I'm being repressed. Monty Python is so useful for so many things.
Are you a pacifist?
Am I a pacifist? Oh, look, these are all, you know, look, we haven't talked about this before. We can nail it in 5 minutes, can't we? Christianity is the state, coercive power, violence. where do we start with this? Without I think these are huge issues, which, you know, probably require a podcast series. Look, just to summarize the position, Yoda was a definite pacifist, and there have been other Christian pacifists through the ages who take very seriously Christ's nonviolent way of the cross. So I think on that count, they are fundamentally, they're seeing something central in Christianity, that we have to be clear that about Christ's rejection of violence, and that his going to the cross and is willing to suffer rather than to make others suffer. So that's a baseline for a Christian ethic. But what does that mean? As we said, that gets the more you start to multiply out the different contexts and circumstances, and it gets more sticky as to what this looks like in this situation or that. So I think the example you mentioned was, you know, once Christians represent a significant portion of the population, and then you have a context where the military is out there either defending the frontiers or something, you know, do we continue to denounce the military while also living in the benefit of the safety that it keeps, you know, benefiting from it keeping us safe from the barbarians, for example, or something like that?
Yeah, like in the Roman context, the early Christians are a very small minority.
Yeah.
And yet they're living on, Alan Crider calls it, that community of peace. And yet that community of peace arguably only exists because of the Pax Romana, which is maintained by the sword.
Yeah. Look, so it's huge, huge issues. We're getting into political theology. Maybe we shouldn't try and solve it. But here's my I think, where I land at for the moment. And I the first thing I'm happy to say is that I don't have a completely sorted out position of this. So I think the Christian position is mostly pacifist, but not in the sense, I can't go the full hog of the pacifist who say we shouldn't have a police force, we shouldn't have a military, because I can't see that. So I'd accept what Oliver O'Donovan argues, is that the state is not just, so where Yoda just claims that the state has a monopoly on organized violence, O'Donovan wants to say something more positive than that. He actually says, this isn't an institution that bears authority for exacting just judgments in society. And that's why that's what the state bears the sword for. That's Paul's language in Romans 13. The state bears the sword for judging wrong. And that's a theology of political authority. Now that's a bigger topic than we can get into, but I think there's something in that. And that includes defense of a people, includes instituting order. And so he makes a good distinction. It's not just violence, it's forceful judgment. It's judgment. And you can call it coercion and violence, but it's backed up by this other thing called authority, which has to be recognized and accepted by people. When it's not there, then it's just tyranny and it's just violence. But when there's this thing called authority, it assumes a different moral character. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something in that. I think, you know, what about war? I think Thomas Aquinas, a great medieval scholastic theologian, philosopher, came up with theory of just war, which has often been ridiculed by people who have never read it or understood it. a lot more to it than that. And I think there's a lot in it that needs to be taken seriously. That said, if you take seriously Aquinas' view of just war theory, most of the wars of the 20th century and the 21st century, for that matter, have been unjust wars, the wars that a lot of the wars Australia have been in. So should Christians be involved in the military? I would sort of think, why would you do that? You know, at a very practical sense, why? If it means you ended up fighting in wars like going to Iraq, which was a terrible thing to be involved in, why would you do that? But I can't be against the idea of the military. So does that mean that Christians should never join? I don't know.
And I sometimes think about John the Baptist. I mean, it's a very different situation, but the soldiers come to John the Baptist and say, well, what should we do? And he doesn't say, just get out of the military, guys. Like, that's the only way to be even morally close to morally right. He says, well, just be a good soldier, don't abuse your power. But as you say, it's very hard when your commanding officer says, all right, we're going to Iraq. What then do you do?
Your prime minister says that, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the I'm no expert, but I suspect one of the contributing factors to the very high level of post-traumatic stress from soldiers coming back from those places has been that unstated effect of being involved in a place which they suspect they never should have been involved in, and in conflicts that, you know, and what the hell are we doing here? Yeah, look, it's complex stuff, and I don't think we should try and sort it out here. But let's just pay attention to the fact, at least, that what we're dealing with is the mess of history brought about by this huge shift. And what we're sort of having to do is now unravel these positions and rethink all of this stuff. So we're actually having to, what we are right, you know, you and I right now are doing is actually engaging in rethinking and what we're all having to do. And that's a one way of summarizing the historical moment in which we live and the task that is before us.
Yeah. Previous assumptions no longer hold. Previous ways of operating don't work anymore. Yeah. So, I mean, wealth is the other one, that like a really big one for the Australian context. There's heaps to read about that. But with these things, it's just, we have a fresh opportunity to look at the Bible again, look at Jesus' words again, and go, oh, what actually does that require of us?
Yeah, yeah. And who was it? A great Christian. Oh, a studded Kennedy once wrote, you know, Christ calls us to take up the cross, and one of the crosses we must take up now is to think really hard about things, because we need to re-engage the Bible, re-engage Christ, but we need to read history as well. We need to understand the currents and learn from it. We need to learn from all that's happened before us, because there's both positive and moral and negative moral lessons from which we need to we should take heed.
I think that's a pretty good note that we can try and end on. We're never going to, as you say, resolve all these things in a 50-minute conversation. Thanks for listening, everyone. And if you are thinking hard about this stuff and you've got further questions about anything we've talked about here, or something's come up in other episodes, send them in, because we're toying around with doing a Q&A podcast one day or something like that. So we want to know what you guys think about this or what it brings up for you. And we really appreciate you listening. If there's other people you think who would appreciate this episode, please send it along. Send any other episodes along too, and give us a review while you're there on the platform you get your podcasts. As we've mentioned, we also do Manor Matters. That's the quarterly publication of Managum. That comes out 3 times a year, and it's completely free. You can get it online or by post. You just sign up on our website, managum.org.au, and you'll find some really meaty, thoughtful pieces, long ones sometimes, short ones sometimes, about practical things, as well as big theory stuff about government, politics, all the rest of it. So that's the place to go, managum.org.au. While you're there, you could also sign up to be a donator. We are funded entirely by donations at Managum, so we really appreciate everyone who makes this work possible. Thanks for listening. Thanks, John. I appreciated your thoughts, and it's a very stimulating conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Jacob. Fun.
We'll catch you guys on the next episode.